We will talk this hour about what President George W. Bush has dubbed the Freedom Agenda, and how, when he said in his second inaugural address, the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands, he made this Freedom Agenda the central theme of his administration's foreign policy. We will talk with a guest this hour who agrees with the idea of spreading democracy, but not with the way that it has been implemented by the Bush administration. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 past 8 on this Tuesday, October the 21st. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest this hour about the Freedom Agenda, whether it is a good idea or not for the U.S. to try to spread democracy around the world, and how this should be accomplished. 1-800-642-1234, toll-free from anywhere, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is James Traub. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He has written several books, including The Devil's Playground, and his latest is The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Morning, Joy.
Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted.
Well, now, this the so-called Freedom Agenda, that's what George Bush calls it, but this has been around for a long time.
Yeah, one of the things I point out in the book is that this is just this thing America does, quite independent from whether we do it well or not, just as the French are thought of as having this so-called mission civilatrice, a civilizing mission. From the time America was a global power, which I date from around 1900 or so, when we conquered the Philippines, we have had this idea that our goal is to universalize these democratic principles that we have. So even our colonial experience in the Philippines was a kind of long-running and ultimately not very successful experiment in trying to bring democracy to this impoverished country.
Yeah. Other examples over the years of how...
Well, the happy ones are Germany and Japan after World War II. Their very intense American engagement economically, politically, culturally took these two fascist countries, which had very little democratic background, and 8-10 years later they emerged as what they have continued to be ever since then, which is bulwarks of the democratic world.
Yeah. So why do you say this is it is a good idea to for the U.S. to spread democracy?
Well, here's my underlying premise, which is even before 9/11, the world of globalization meant that threats, not just like terrorism, but narcotics, crime, even the kind of financial disaster we've seen now, were much greater threats to us than enemy countries were. And the places where those threats tended to gather were weak and authoritarian states. Afghanistan, of course, became the ultimate example after 9/11, which I think added this new element of danger, which produced the following thought. It is more important to us to try to do something about what is happening inside states than it is to try to manage the external behavior of states, because it is these failed states and authoritarian states which are the incubators of these dangerous forces. Now, that doesn't mean we can do very much about it. It means that we need to think very hard about what we can do and where we can do it.
Yeah, so where did George Bush and the Bush administration go wrong with their freedom agenda?
Well, I guess everywhere. I think there are a couple obvious things. One is a complete lack of seriousness about the difficulty of the task. Political cultures are intransigent. It takes a long time for democracies to develop. Our own and those of Western countries develop slowly and organically over generations. And so the act itself requires a tremendous amount of modesty. That's quite leaving aside whether we, the United States, are the ones who can best do this. So the inherent difficulty of the thing added to the place where they chose to do this, the Arab world, which is the most undemocratic region of the globe, and the place where it would be hardest, if you were to choose, to try to do something to help nurture democratic forces. So there was this kind of magical sense that through rhetorical declarations on our part, exhortations, we could somehow work this miraculous transformation. That's one. Two, of course, was Iraq. Now, we did not go into Iraq to bring democracy to the Iraqi people. We went there because we thought Saddam Hussein posed a clear and present danger to us. But all this was accompanied by a great deal of language about how we were going to democratize Iraq and the whole Middle East. Well, of course, because that has been a grotesque failure, and because, rightly or wrongly, everybody sees Iraq as the very definition of what this administration is, therefore the whole idea of democracy promotion has become completely wrapped up in regime change, wrapped up in warfare, and wrapped up in all of the terrible mistakes the administration has made there.
Yeah. So we only have an hour to go here, but what should the Bush administration have done differently? What would have been a better way to spread democracy over the past 8 years?
Well, a couple things. One is, if they were going to invade Iraq, they should not have accompanied with this language about democracy. Or if they were going to take this seriously, they should have said, democracy is a matter of long, slow institution building. They should have seen Iraq as a colossal challenge in terms of trying to build liberal and democratic institutions in a place that didn't have any. These guys didn't believe in nation building. Remember, that was part of the that's what Bill Clinton did, we don't do that stuff mentality of the administration. So first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq, they went in, toppled a regime, and then just imagined that something new would grow in its place. And life doesn't work like that. And of course, what filled the vacuum was the civil war that has been raging ever since. And so first they should have taken seriously what is the nature of this enterprise and should have committed themselves to state building. Then I think also you cannot tell the world that it should adopt this difficult, noble experiment of democracy unless you are at the same time going to make yourself a real exemplar of democracy. We live in a transparent world. Everything we do is going to be seen. It's often going to be seen through a distorted lens, but it's going to be seen. And so if the world overhears us debating whether we can torture enemy combatants and who's allowed to torture them and what kind of torture is allowed, well, what kind of message does that send about our commitment to democracy? The same, I would say, with Guantanamo, that we would create this prison in a non-existent jurisdiction so that we wouldn't have to apply the strictures of our own constitution. What does that say about our commitment to democratic principles? And so if you are going to be professing any set of noble principles, you put yourself under a much greater responsibility to behave according to them. And so that would have made a difference as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you've noted, colossal mistakes have been made, but I'm wondering if ultimately Iraq, for example, will be this shining example of democracy in the Middle East that the Bush administration
don't believe that anymore. I mean, they may talk that way, but I think they'd be perfectly happy if they could find an effective authoritarian leader who would just be able to end the sectarian strife. So there's been a serious scaling back of expectations as they've come to understand how naive and reckless they were, 5, 6 years ago. So I don't think one can put too much store by Iraq, and I think in general that the effort to make a transformative difference in the Middle East has failed. It's not just in Iraq. I mean, this whole freedom agenda was first rolled out when the president spoke about solving the Israel-Palestine problem. He said, we have a whole new paradigm. None of these complicated 11th-hour negotiations that Clinton and others engaged in. No, we are going to make a new declaration with a new paradigm. And he said in June of 2002, he gave a speech where he directly addressed the Palestinian people, and he said, if you can get rid of your corrupt leadership, meaning Yasser Arafat, and if you can clean up your government and adopt democratic principles, then we will recognize a Palestinian state. Well, again, again, that was a kind of call for magical transformation. It wasn't at all clear what, if anything, the United States was going to do to help that happen. It was more as if we issued the clarion call, something good would happen. So that was the first one. The next one was Iraq. And that even wasn't the last one. In 2005, the administration made a genuinely concerted effort, really an unprecedented push in Egypt, to say to Hosni Mubarak, the authoritarian president of Egypt, we want you to open up the system. There are real democratic forces in this country, and by keeping a tight lid on them, ultimately Egypt is going to explode. You have to be able to open up some of the pressure. And so there was a Condi Rice went there and said, for 60 years we have supported stability as against democracy, and we have gotten neither. And now we call on the Egyptian government to allow freer elections, a more free press, end of torture, arbitrary justice, and so on. And it was quite a shock for the Egyptians to hear, and it was thrilling for all that they loathed Bush administration policy. Nevertheless, the fact that someone could actually say to Mubarak, back off, let these people have real democratic freedoms, was very exciting. The Egyptians had an election. It was more hotly contested and seriously contested than any election it had before. Mubarak got petrified because he was losing badly in parliamentary elections. And so he sent out his goon squad into the streets. People were beaten and killed. As many as 20 people were killed. It became impossible for people to express their preferences at the polls. It was a devastating blow to all those hopes. And the Bush administration said nothing. They had concluded that they couldn't afford to offend Mubarak, and that was it. That was effectively the end of the democratic moment in Egypt, and really effectively the end of the real freedom agenda.
We are talking with James Traub. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times, and he is the author of the new book, The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Very happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Hope you will also join us if you're anywhere in the area in Stevens Point this Friday. Our statewide tour that we call the Joyride stops in Stevens Point this Friday. We'll be broadcasting on location from the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point Student Center from 6 until 9 in the morning. Different guests will be talking about trivia and politics, and we'll have two guests reviewing the news of the week. And we'd love to have you on location with us at the Lee Sherman Dreyfus Center at the UW Student Center, UW Stevens Point Student Center on Friday. More information on our website, WPR.org. Right now we're talking with James Traub. He is the author of The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. And we welcome your thoughts and questions on whether or not it is a good idea for the U.S. to try to spread democracy around the world, and how the Bush administration did it, and how it shouldn't be done that way anymore. And I'm wondering, before we go to the phones, James Traub, what should the Obama or McCain administration be doing? What, if you were advising them or rewriting the Freedom Agenda, what would you be telling them to do?
Well, Joy, the first thing I would say is, let's for a second leave aside what they should do. It's a really negative environment that has been created by these failures. That is, I think there's a real national exhaustion with the idea of idealistic, bold foreign policy ventures, because all that seems to have come to disaster in Iraq. And I think also the kind of magnificent rhetoric that the president used, this almost theological rhetoric when he talked about democracy, has not only sickened people abroad who are the supposed benefactors of this, but has also, I think, kind of wearied Americans. Mm-hmm. And so the task for Obama or for McCain is to find a way of talking about basic American principles that remind people that it really matters to most Americans that we're seen as a force for good in the world, because I think otherwise there's a real danger of a kind of national retrenchment that would say, in effect, let's just stop doing harm to the world. Let's tend to our own garden, especially given the economic crisis. It creates very powerful impulses to tend to our own garden. And so some part of this is language, finding a new language which doesn't seem so self-righteous and so arrogant and so grandiose, but instead does remind people of why these things are important. I think a much more modest language which says, we believe profoundly in democracy and our own democracy, but we recognize that we're flawed too. All democracies are flawed. Democracy is an experiment. And we have to be honest about our own failures, including, I would say, the failures that came after 9/11. And so there's the difference in language. We need a sense of both modesty and persistence. Instead of these tremendous declarations like the one I was describing in Egypt, followed by nothing, we need to make, I think, more modest declarations followed by a much more persistent effort to do the kind of institution building and all the sort of slow and frustrating work, as well as the important moments when we have to come to the aid of democratic forces, but as well as this slower stuff without which you cannot hope to build up weak or failed or autocratic states.
To the phones we go. Chris in Oshkosh is first. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to say I agree with your author 100%, and I'd like to compare this idea of spreading democracy to spreading a religious ideal. Christianity, for instance, I think all Christians believe that they're supposed to spread Christianity, but some Christian churches believe that you need to go out on the streets and picket abortion clinics and tell people they're sinners and get involved in the political process, where there's other Christian churches which believe that you lead more by example, live a good life so that people want to be part of what you're doing. And I think that's kind of what the author is getting at here. If we have troops on the ground in another country where we're trying to force them to be a democratic nation, but they're looking at us and we have a financial crisis and we have the situation with Ted Stevens and we have politicians going to prison for defrauding the nation and our presidential campaign, our presidential nominees spreading ridiculous lies about each other on the campaign trail, doesn't that just give the theocrats and the terrorists an opportunity to tell people in those regions, why would you want to be a part of that?
Yeah, let me take that analogy one step further. There are religious organizations that just seek to proselytize. And then there are those that seek to do good works abroad as a way of saying to people, this is the nature of our faith. They're still evangelizing, but they're doing it in a way that makes people wish to come to that faith. And so while I'm reluctant to make the, you know, democracy-religion analogy, I do think in that sense it obtains. And so you have to behave in such a way that people are deeply attracted to this thing you're talking about.
Thanks, Chris. We have an email from Sebastian in Appleton who says, over the last 60 years alone, the United States has directly or indirectly been responsible for the undermining of democracy in South Korea, Iran, Guatemala, Chile, the Congo, and others. This history is well known worldwide, less so domestically. On what grounds does the United States have to meddle in other countries' affairs until they acknowledge their long history of anti-democratic subversion worldwide?
I don't actually disagree with that. I mean, there is no question that the Cold War imperative always was, let's support allies, whether they're democratic or no. And I think there's a real danger that the War on Terror imperative is going to create a new version of that. And so we supported General Musharraf in Pakistan, even when hundreds of thousands of people took to the street to in effect, protest the violation of the constitutional order. Now, my question is, what should we do in a situation like that? Should we say, we don't come to this with clean hands, so we shouldn't have any opinion one way or another about what's going on in Pakistan? Or should we say, no, we believe that these democratic forces represent what is best for Pakistan. We recognize that we can't do very much to get the Pakistanis to choose one side or the other, but we want to make it clear where our own sympathies lie. And the fact is, we are a huge supporter of Pakistan. We gave Musharraf $10 billion after 9/11. Well, what should we be doing with that money? How should we be using both our diplomatic and financial power to bring good outcomes in Pakistan? So I don't think that the United States has a choice simply to withdraw, and I think it would be a terrible thing if it did. The world needs us and depends on us too much for all of our bad history. And so we have to make choices, and my argument is that we should choose to try to help democratic forces as opposed to autocratic forces.
Next we go to Tom in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I feel that we are sometimes for freedom and democracy when it serves our own interest. And I also feel often we try to spread, here again, our own so-called freedom and democracy through the end of a gun barrel, as in the case of Afghanistan and Iraq. And finally, sometimes, you know, the way it's going, sometimes I really wonder if those two countries really do want our style of democracy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the last question that your questioner posed was the hardest one. That is clearly, one shouldn't try to impose democracy through the barrel of a gun, and Iraq has proved that disaster. On the other hand, Afghanistan, if we agree that we did indeed have to act there, then once we acted, we had a profound responsibility to the Afghanis and to ourselves to try to bring good outcomes there. But your listener's last question was the hard one. What does a good outcome mean? Does a good outcome mean Western-style democracy? Does it mean something that looks much more like traditional political forms? For example, in Afghanistan, their system of adjudication and also political consultation is this lawyer jirga, you know, where elders get together and make decisions. That's not really democratic. I think that in every case, it's kind of like the point an earlier listener made about Christianity. Democracy is a, if not a universal, it certainly seems to me to be a near universal aspiration. People want to have a voice in their own affairs. They want to have a lot of good things that democracy tends to deliver. But it also will take the particular form of the place in question. And so these traditions like lawyer jirga are going to be at the very least critical transitional institutions as countries develop a more secularized kind of democracy. And so we need to sort of figure out which ones of these traditions actually work well for people, or pardon me, I shouldn't say that, they need to figure out which ones work well for them, and how one shifts between what would seem like the indispensable elements of a democracy, for example, political parties, a free press, and then things which will be different depending on local traditions. So I think, you know, there's no hard and fast answer to that question.
James Traub, our guest, his book, The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. And our next caller is Tom in River Falls. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think we need to first clarify the very definition of the word democracy. In the book Wealth and Democracy by former Republican Kevin Phillips, he talks about this conflation and confusion of capitalism and democracy. And when you hear Bush and the conservatives talk about spreading liberty and freedom, they're not really thinking like we're thinking democracy, freedom. They're thinking free markets. And a guy on the Heritage Foundation a couple months ago was being interviewed by Lou Dobbs, and he made the claim that France was more communistic than China because their market was more regulated than autocratic China's was. So this confusion, liberals tend to think of freedom as democracy. Conservatives think of freedom as free market laissez-faire capitalism and don't really understand that, you know, the economic system should be subservient to the political system of democracy. They want to flip that around the other way. I'd like to hear your guest comment.
That's a very good point. I love that comment by the Heritage Foundation guy that you mentioned. That's an absolutely perfect reflection of a certain kind of mentality. I think one of the failures of the Bush administration was to talk about democracy as if it only consisted of liberty. That is to say, if it only consisted of get your hands off me individual freedom, which is an indispensable part. There is no democracy that can exist without that. But the things people hunger for in their daily lives, which they would use words like justice and dignity, and those have as much to do with social rights and economic rights, those are not things that are nearly as foundational to the American idea of democracy as they are in other places, including, for that matter, in Western Europe, which is why this Heritage Foundation guy made this crack about France. It's a different conception of what democracy means. And if we are going to propound an idea of democracy which is only political, then how is that going to speak to people's basic desire to have a better life? Democracy has to prove that it can deliver, both in the political sense of sense of dignity and security, and in the economic sense of a better life. Because after all the countries where we are talking about trying to bring democracy are impoverished places where people are desperate to have a better life. And democracy, I think, can be an instrument for economic improvement, but we have to be open about talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Tom, anything else?
Yeah, it's just that this has been their mantra, the conservatives, for 30 years, to unravel the New Deal by Franklin Roosevelt, and they consider that communistic. You know, the Social Security is socialistic and Medicare, and these are things that actually saved democracy from falling apart during the last Republican Great Depression. So it's really this constant confusion of capitalism and democracy.
I think, you know, to add one point to that, why were the Bush administration folks so hostile to the idea of nation building? Because they thought it was socialism. Mm-hmm. Because they thought nation building is exactly the kinds of things that we did to get out of the Depression, which, as your listeners said, they ideologically object to. So they thought, why should we be bringing big government politics to foreign countries when they need to be liberated by the free market? And so they imagined. I mean, some of the books about Iraq are really telling on this, that we brought over sort of doctrinal operatives from the Republican Party, brought them to Baghdad, plunked them down in the green zone, and they imagined that they were going to create a thriving market in this place where there weren't even the barest rudiments of security. I mean, it would have been laughable were it not so catastrophic.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Tom, for the call. Now we go to Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Thanks for taking my call. One point right off, I'd just like to say I kind of wish we would stop using the word democracy. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. I wish our president wouldn't use it. There's a big difference. But my point predominantly is that I think Americans really don't understand. I think, unfortunately, the failure of the Bush administration was that they did not really totally understand or weren't being realistic with the complexity of the Middle East. I think oftentimes we want simplistic answers to very complex world problems. I mean, we have to first of all look at the nature of radical Islam. Radical Islam looks at us as the great Satan. They hate everything about us. And they are out to annihilate Western civilization, period. And in that particular setting, it's going to be very difficult to build a stable national government in any of those regions. And it's not going to happen overnight. It didn't happen overnight in Germany. It didn't happen overnight in Japan. And it's not going to happen overnight anywhere. Unfortunately, the U.S. tends to take the brunt that the U.N. should be taking because they do nothing. So that's basically my comment.
Yeah, hold on, Tim. James Traub?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. One is we're a Republican democracy, by which I mean the following. A republic is a state that has a government which permits a certain set of freedoms. There have been republics since Athens. A democracy is one where those representatives are directly elected by more or less universal franchise, and so we're a democracy too. All of the Western democracies are republics who have become democracies. Democracy is a later development of republicanism. Now, as to the point about Islam, I agree with that, of course, and that was my point about the kind of fantasy element of all this. But I do think when we think about if we can we do anything at all in the Arab world, the very important question is what should we say about moderate Islamist parties in Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and elsewhere that are now part of the political process? The Bush administration has essentially paid them no heed. They have pretended as if they don't exist. This is the form that democratic, that popular democracy takes in the Arab world, in part because the secular parties have been crushed. But the Islamist parties are, by and large, these are not folks who want to produce some version of a Saudi, or for that matter, an Iranian kind of theocratic state. They act democratically within those places. Their aspirations may ultimately be religious, but at least the ones that they immediately advance and seem, from my conversations, genuinely to believe in are political ones, are democratic ones. And I do think that it's going to be important for our next administration to come to grips with this basic political fact about the Arab world and to find a way to begin to engage with moderate Islamist parties.
Yeah. Did you have a follow-up, Tim?
I would agree with that. I think, unfortunately, I think we need to stop blaming the U.S. for everything. We're not the problem to every... Now, we've made some dumb mistakes. We have throughout history. This is not an anomaly to this particular situation. I know people love to bash the Bush administration, and they have done some dumb things. But there were amazing blunders made during World War II. There have always been amazing blunders because you're dealing with a very, very complex situation. These aren't simple scenarios, and you have to look at the big picture in order to understand them. Thank you.
James Trapp?
I couldn't agree more. I think that whether McCain or Obama is our next president, he's going to find that any attempt to change, to improve the political cultures of the Arab world, to nurture democratic forces, is going to run up against these autocratic regimes. And they will quickly discover the limits of what any outsider, ourselves included, can do.
Our guest is James Traub. He is the author of The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. In the book, James Traub says that while America must spread democracy abroad, it must exercise caution, respect political stability, and human rights. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you between 9 and 11. You can call in with your suggestions for programs and guests and topics. It's Kathleen's Open Line coming up after 9 o'clock, her October Open Line in our next hour. We are talking with James Traub for the rest of this hour. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He has written several books, including The Devil's Playground. And we are talking about the ideas in his new book, The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. And our next caller is Anne in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question is about history. The act as if democracy was just divinely, imparted to us as a revelation, and our leaders talk about it that way. But it's not true. I mean, it arose out of a particular set of historical circumstances. We had these Enlightenment figures who in turn drew upon, the history of Renaissance rediscovery of Greek systems of government. And that's our particular historical circumstance, which does not exist everywhere by any means. And so I'm wondering if what role and attention to history might play in all of this.
It's a very good question, but it cuts two different ways. That is, the inattention to the particular circumstances of the Arab world and the Middle East is part of what made these folks so reckless and kind of guileless. They thought, for example, Condi Rice, who had served in the administration of the first President Bush, she had seen the world of Eastern Europe transformed while she had been there, and those countries had become democracies. And so that was her source of reference. She thought, we did it there. We can do it here. Well, anybody who had a sense of history and geography would see that the one thing wouldn't translate very well to the other. So to that extent, I agree. But here is an important caveat, which is there is no set formula whereby democracies develop. The Western democracies more or less developed in the same way. First, they developed a middle class or a merchant class, and those classes over time began to demand a set of political rights which were satisfied by a growing, increasingly universal franchise, which led to a real democracy. Now, that's not the explanation for India. It's not the explanation for Kenya or Tanzania or Ghana. And God knows it isn't the explanation for really recent democracies in Africa, places like Mali, which are just pathetically poor and yet actually do have meaningful political institutions. And so there is a tendency to say, look, these guys are not ready for democracy. You have to go through all these stages like we did and like Western European countries did. First, you have to have a middle class. Then you can have democracy. Well, that's just not so, it turns out. And the fact is people want this thing, and you can't say to them, you're not ready. We're going to help you have elections if you come back in 25 years when you are ready. And so if you're a diplomat, if you're a policymaker, things like this present themselves to you, and you have to decide what you're going to do. And you can't say, sorry, you're not ready, come back later.
And thank you for the call. Steve in Houston, Texas, is with us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, a couple points. I think we need to do a couple things. We need to stand behind the existing democracies that have been around for the last 50 years. I'm thinking specifically in Asia of Taiwan, which is facing increasing threat from China, one of our allies, and South Korea. You know, we stood behind South Korea as a model democracy. I've been there many times. My children have studied there in exchange programs, and it's one of the great examples in the world of a strong democracy with religious freedom. And, you know, it's facing increasing threat from a very belligerent and very arrogant and unstable North Korea. And in our hemisphere, you can look at the situation in Colombia. It's very fearful. I'm a wholesaler of flowers, and I import about $1 million in roses a year. A lot of people don't realize the importance of Colombia as an ally and as a trading partner with America. And right now, as we speak, Venezuela, which has purchased, I believe, upwards of $3 billion in arms from Russia, Mr. Putin's KGB Russia, you know, Russia has warships over there in training, and they're creating instability in many, many nations, in Bolivia, in Ecuador, you know, in Nicaragua with Mr. Ortega coming back, the old communist that we had to fight back in the 80s with Oliver North. You know, if we don't stand behind nations like Colombia, you know, when I hear Mr. Obama and Nancy Pelosi saying, well, you know, their trade unions are oppressing their people, if we pull out of supporting them, I guarantee you, I'm a student of history, Colombia will fall to communism and South America will become a basket case if we don't stand behind our allies. And this is where you see the difference between Democrats and Republicans.
All right. All right, Steve. Steve's very passionate. Let's talk about Colombia. Let's talk about the Colombia example first, James.
Well, let me say this. Yes, there are democracies that are threatened by autocratic neighbors. I don't think communism is the problem. Communism is dead, but autocracy sure isn't dead. And so, yes, in a case like I think the cases that Steve mentioned, he's right. But there are a lot of democracies that are much more threatened by their own weakness. That's a way bigger problem. I mean, you look at countries like Thailand or Bangladesh. These are countries that either were democracies and now are backsliding or are threatened by backsliding, or it's almost not clear what you should call them. And then we have these profoundly impoverished democracies that are really in danger of being failed states, and that their political system is so weak that even though they're democracies, it's almost in name only. And I think a big concern for the next administration is going to be, what can you do to help these weak states? And this, by the way, is something Obama has talked about a lot. McCain has not. McCain talks about democracy kind of in the ways that Bush does. Obama has had a much bigger focus on the problem of weak and failed states as dangers to ourselves and as challenges to our own abilities. And it's interesting that the military just produced something called the Stabilization Operations Manual. And what that said, it was a doctrine. And it said that in the future, the ability to help stabilize weak states is going to be as important as warfighting abilities. And so I think this recognition has really dawned among military folks who are the ones who are out there on the front line seeing the consequences of collapsed states. I think it's actually come much, much more slowly to political decision makers.
Yeah. What role should the U.S. have, James Traub, in the conflict, the hostilities between Russia and Georgia?
Well, you know, Joy, that's something I've actually written about a fair amount. And to me, it's pretty clear cut. I mean, I think the Georgians may have done some provocative things, but Putin was looking for any source of any pretext he could use to attack Georgia. There is no question that he's been seeking to do so for months, because he wants to demonstrate not just to the Georgians, but to his neighbors, not just to his neighbors, but to everybody, that Russia is not going to accept what they see as a gathering status quo in which the West becomes increasingly dominant, including along its own borders. They would not accept NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine. They will not accept Georgia, Ukraine, and others being orienting themselves to the West and not being sufficiently deferential in the view of the Russians towards Russia. And so I think in that case, in a way, we almost don't need the question of democracy here, because in some ways Putin behaved the same way Saddam Hussein did in Kuwait in 1990. He committed an act of aggression against his neighbor. And that alone should have been enough to cause international outcry. It didn't, in part because people were afraid of offending Russia. But there is the additional fact that Georgia and Ukraine are democratic states. They're flawed democratic states. Mm-hmm. That's not surprising, but they are democratic states. Russia is an increasingly autocratic state. And so I think it's not enough to say, as some have, we have a lot of fish to fry with Russia and not with Georgia, so let's not harm our relations with Russia in order to stand by Georgia. I think that's deluding ourselves about Russia. I think the Russians right now are not in a mood to play by the international rules. I think it's crucial that we continue to talk with Russia about issues like Iran, issues of energy and nuclear nonproliferation. But we cannot let the Russians feel that they can dictate who will be our allies and who will not, who will get into NATO and who will not, and how their neighbors ought to behave towards them. I think this is an extremely aggressive act on the part of the Russians, and we have to make it clear that they're going to pay a price for doing that.
Back to the phones. John in Racine is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Let me ask you a question. If it's about freedom and democracy, because there's been conflicts going on forever, why don't we really intervene with the Israeli-Palestinian issue? Because they've been under a military occupation for about 50 years now, and we seem to bounce around and not solve anything there. So if it's really about freedom and democracy for all people, why don't we solve that problem? Because we have the power to do so, but we don't.
Well, I wish we had the power to solve that problem. We sure have the power to do a better job of solving that problem than we have. I think, Bush's declaration to the Palestinians, they quickly realized that was a non-starter, and they actually had no choice but to get involved in all of the ugly and gritty details of that, and they didn't make a whole lot of headway. Clinton got a lot closer to solving the problem. But you can't depict this as being a one-sided conflict in which an occupying country is mistreating those who are occupied. Israel has, in many ways, mistreated the Palestinians. They have committed serious violations of human rights. At the same time, they are a nation under threat of extinction. And so one has to accept the legitimacy of both sides' concerns about the way they are treated and about their own survival. And that's why it's such a very difficult issue.
John, thank you. Now to an email from Wayne in San Mateo, California. Lots of people listening from other parts of the country. While living in several developing countries in Latin America and Africa, it's been my observation that many share certain conditions that limit their ability to create a democracy, thus experience serious social and economic consequences. Those conditions are limited access to justice, a wide disparity in the distribution of wealth with a small middle class, the ability to influence the electorate to vote against its own interests by resorting to emotional ideological appeals, and a high level of corruption. Are any of these conditions familiar? It seems to me that the U.S. must first get its own house in order if it expects to change minds in other parts of the world. Your reaction to that, James Trout?
Well, that question took a funny turn I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. Because if we leave aside the second half of it, which, I agree, but the problems really between the United States and impoverished third world countries are not commensurate. But the problems that your emailer identified, the structural problems, that's the real issue. And so we have to recognize that it is a very long, slow business to begin to put aside these problems of corruption and tribalism and civil war and weakness of political parties. This is the work of generations. It is, above above all, the work of these countries themselves. And the question is, to what extent and in what way can outsiders help the United States among them? And I think this is why I've talked about the difficulty of indispensability of building weak states, of state building. And as I say, this is an effort that many parts of the United States government can have a role in, including in various ways the military. But we have to see ourselves as one part of a much larger effort, which above all begins in those countries, but involves the United Nations, involves our allies, and just involves a lot of work and a tremendous amount of frustration, which requires a lot of persistence.
Next, we go to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just want to say that I think that if we're going to promote democracy in the world, we have to take our blinders off and take the self-serving nature of the way we promote democracy out of the equation. You know, I think the Russian example is a classic example. Doesn't anybody see the hypocrisy of this country trying to tell the Russians that they can't meddle in a country on its own border that has historically been in its sphere of interest, that has historically been in its interest to have as a buffer? And when we sort of willy-nilly intervene in Iraq without any justification, intervene in Afghanistan because we see it in our interest, and would certainly invade any nation in South America if we thought it was in our interest, as we have done within recent decades in Grenada and Panama and all sorts of places. And for us to say that the Russians are not playing by the rules of the world order because they have an interest in seeing what happens in Georgia, I think is the utmost height of hypocrisy. And we go around the world, we talk about Venezuela as if it were a totalitarian state when it's probably the most legitimate democracy in South America.
All right.
And is trying to do something for its people.
We get to Stephen. I don't mean to cut you short, but we are short on time. So James Traub?
If the alternative is we should just say nothing when the Russians invade Georgia because our hands aren't clean, I think that would be a terrible thing, and that would be a terrible abandonment of the Georgians. So I agree that we have allowed the sort of elements of the Monroe Doctrine to linger. We don't, in fact, invade Mexico. And Russia was not simply meddling with Georgia. Russia invaded Georgia and would have taken Georgia over, I think, if they felt that they had half a chance of doing so. And it was only because they realized that the West rallied to Georgia's side, above all the United States, that they basically stopped on the road to Tbilisi, and they stopped before they actually had toppled the government of Georgia. So, no, I thought that behavior was unacceptable. And by the way, Venezuela is not even remotely the most democratic country in South America. South America now has fully democratic nations. I mean, Brazil is a democratic country. Chile is a democratic country. Peru is a democratic country, certainly more so than Venezuela. Venezuela has an elected government and a popularly elected government.
Yeah.
But it is an extremely flawed democracy on its way to being a thoroughly autocratic state.
And I'm afraid we're out of time. James Traub, thank you so much for coming on and talking with our callers.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
James Traub, author of The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour. Thanks to Rob Ferret and Cynthia Schuster for on-air production and direction. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.